Hello, I'm Preston Schleinkofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disaster might affect you. The coronavirus is just such an example of why we need community-based grassroots organizations to help our neighbors and communities when the next crisis hits. This week, we are speaking with Glenn Rhodes, National Operations Director for the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Glenn is my boss at the task force, and I am the Eastern Regional Director under his guidance. This week, I wish to give a shout-out to Brian Colburn at Sitch Radio for making these podcasts sound great and helping me stay on task. He edits and hosts my show on his platform and distributes it to the various podcast apps. If you are considering starting a podcast, Brian has everything you need to get started and have great shows like this one. So you can go and check him out at www.sitchradio.com. That's Sitch, S-I-T-C-H, radio.com. And he'll help you out. He's a great guy, and I'll tell you, man, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't partly for him. All right? Now, our guest today is Glenn Rhodes, National Operations Director for the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security. Hello, Glenn. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks a lot for having me on, Preston. I really appreciate this, because this is obviously an important message, and especially in light of what we're going through nationally right now.
Oh yeah, this coronavirus, man. It could be a lot worse than what it looks like it's going to be. I think we've kind of our nation is very, very resilient, but we also have the ability to bring things to market that need to be done. I think we might be getting there with some of the things that the task force that the president created is bringing the bear.
Well, yeah, and this is hitting home personally, especially with me. We just got back from Europe, which was a whole new story, and a whole new experience. We were on the last flight out of Iceland, so it was kind of interesting. If we have time later on, maybe we could go into a little bit of that. But right now, I think the important thing is just to give you a little bit of my background, how I got started with this thing, and how you eventually got on board, because you're a key member on the Eastern Coast. That's where, we have the Eastern Grid, and millions of people are dependent on the electrical power grid to maintain their safety and their health and everything else. So for me, I had worked, for Martin Marietta and Lockheed Martin as an aerospace planner for 16 years. And in 99, I decided to retire and choose a different direction in my career. One of my fellow engineers was a guy named Randy Dehoff, and he was on the State Board of Education for Colorado, and he asked me to run for an office, state office. I did that. It didn't work out. I lost the election, but the National Science Foundation asked me to do a special project for them to start a nanotechnology lab. And as some of you listeners may know, the world and human beings are impacted by four major powers in the universe. They're called gravity is one, electromagnetism, which is another, and then strong and weak nuclear bonding. And so it just so happened that when the National Science Foundation reached out to me, they said, hey, even though you lost the election, we're trying to look for a nanotechnology lab to be built here in Colorado based on the 21st Century Nanotechnology Development Act. And two people at the University of Denver were critical in forming and formulating the strategy for the national nanotechnology development for the United States. And they were helping Senator Ron Wyden, who's a Democratic senator out of Oregon. So got on board with that, and it took about 3.5 years, but we created the very first nanotechnology lab at the University of Colorado in 2016. And that was, I felt it was quite an accomplishment. I didn't do it alone, certainly. There were a lot of people that helped me out. But it allowed me to understand that I have a real knack that I didn't realize before of kind of translating science and some of the technical aspects of science to the general public. Not very many people have the ability to do that. There are a few people in the United States that really are good at doing that. You know, Bill Nye is one guy, you know, for example.
Yeah.
And there's others who are trying to translate, act as translators of science into the into social policy. And so all that was pretty good. And I've always been dabbling in science and some other things. But then in March, on a March 11, 2011, something monumental happened to me. And I don't know if any of your listeners are aware of what happened on that date, but that was when the Tohoku earthquake hit and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant basically failed because they had put it close to the ocean. They thought that they had enough protection, but when the tsunami hit a few minutes later after the reactor had automatically shut down, it inundated the backup emergency generators. And for the first time in my life, I kind of started to understand that which I didn't know before, that nuclear power plants are so dependent on outside power to maintain their safety. So even though the control rods were inserted automatically into the cooling pods immediately after the earthquake, 45 minutes later, then the Japanese were basically in a panic mode, pulling batteries out of their car, not to get the generators back up, but just to take a glimpse of what was happening in that reactor. So it was pretty dire.
Mm.
And as a result of that, because I'm such a nerd, I knew that there are 120 million Americans that live within 50 miles of any one of 23 boiling water reactors and other reactors that are very similar to that Fukushima nuclear reactor. In all, the 104, and that fluctuates, obviously, nuclear reactors that we have, all would be very susceptible to a catastrophic power failure if we had something happen like what we're talking about now. Now, at the time, I did not know about that. I just knew that the water inundated these backup generators. So I told my wife, Karen, who's a nurse at Lutheran Hospital in Denver here, and she's a professor of nursing at one of the local universities. I said, Karen, I've got to find out about this because I'm just very concerned that I didn't realize that we have so much dependent on outside power. So, and that continued cooling is necessary, possibly for weeks and months, if the plant's not restarted. So I went to Google and I Googled long duration power outage on Google here in Colorado. And it led me to a guy named Dr. Daniel Baker. Now, Dr. Daniel Baker is the director of laboratory in atmospheric and space physics, which is called LASP, and they do a lot of instrumentation studies and little satellites for NASA. They are the university portion of NCAR, which is the National Center for Atmospheric Research. This is called UCAR, University Center for Atmospheric Research. And I called Dr. Baker out of the blue and I said, Dr. Baker, you don't know me from Adam, but I need to ask you a couple of questions. I was wondering if you had some time, I could come up to your office and talk to you. And he goes, well, what it's about? And I said, well, it's about power and nuclear power plants. And he said, okay, yeah, come on up. So went up there to Boulder, and I'm a CU alum, so I know the city quite well. And it was there that I learned from Dr. Daniel Baker that the typical backup diesel generators in the United States have enough supplies for 72 to 80 hours at the time and before they need to be resupplied with new fuel. Now, I think that some efforts have been made to increase that to longer periods of time. But he was saying that basically, if we have a long duration power outage, we need to have cool water going over those control rods. And if they don't happen, then we have major problems, right?
Yeah.
So, and up to and including a nuclear meltdown. So I said, well, somebody's working on this, I take it, right? And he said, well, not really. And I go, what do you mean, not really? And he said, well, the grid is pretty complex. You know, when Tesla, Westinghouse, and Edison created the grid, they did not anticipate some of the things that are threatening the grid in 21st century America now. And I said, well, what could threaten it? And that's where he started going into the whole complexity of man and his networks, the fact that the grid is one of the most complex machines ever created, and also that this complex machine is giving us critical interdependencies of infrastructures, including water, food, banking, finance, you name it. Legislative offices need to be functioning, military installations, emergency call centers, fire stations, transportation. Electricity is really the basis for everything that provides safety and viability to a modern societal infrastructure. He went on to say that there is basically three huge grids that make up America. The Eastern Grid, which is approximately 190 plus million people. The Western Grid, where I live, which supports about 100 million people. And then the Texas Grid, which is around 27 million people. And so even though these larger grids comprise the majority, the biggest hunks, there's smaller independent little grids and companies that basically make up the grid and make sure that all the AC lines within the interconnect are all in sync. And it's because, you know, when Tesla, again, Edison and Westinghouse were creating the grid, they thought that an AC grid that uses alternating power would be the best approaches. And so we have these vast lines of transmissions that are carrying these electrical currents across vast distances. And therein kind of lies some of the vulnerabilities. And so I asked Daniel Baker, I said, Dan, well, what could mess up this stuff? What could cause the power to fail? He said, well, from my standpoint, I mean, I'm kind of the expert in with NASA and some of the studies there. But I did a paper that said that we barely missed a few years ago in 2012 CME, or it's called a coronal mass ejection from the sun, that almost took out the grid back in 2012. We missed it by anywhere from 6 to 9 days. And had that hit, Glenn, we would not be sitting here in this Boulder office talking. We would be struggling to survive. And I said, well, how does that work? And he went on to say that it's because of the vulnerabilities that the transformers that make up the backbone of our nation are, we're dependent on. We have over 200,000 miles of unprotected high voltage lines, anywhere from 230 kV and up. We have over 9,000 power generating stations with over 55,000 electrical substations. We have 30 critical substation nodes, and 9 of them, as was exposed in a Wall Street Journal article a few years ago, 9 are supercritical transformer substations. And if any of those go down, it could cause a catastrophic failure of the power grid. So he went on to explain that there's about 2,000, maybe 2,140 somewhat high voltage transformers in the 375 kV to 750 kV or larger. And interestingly enough, for every 13 transformer out there in the field, there's an average of 10 different transformer designs. And many of these original drawings cannot be found anymore. Many are 50 to 40 years old, and they're lost. They'd have to be recreated from scratch. And to recreate a transformer design means that you have to basically monitor it, and basically, because I didn't know this at the time, but he said that basically all these transformers are custom made for that particular substation. So it would take anywhere from 2 to 4 months of electrical design time just to recreate one of these things. At the time, there are 5 U.S. manufacturing facilities that take anywhere from 5 to 20 months to replace these transformers. There are some facilities in Wisconsin, Georgia, Alabama, Texas, or not Texas, but Tennessee and Missouri, and there's other places that are starting. The problem is that the global production of replacing one of these transformers from 300 to 400 tons, it takes anywhere, like I said, from 5 to 20 months. And the global production is 200 a year for the whole world. Mm. So if we lost all 2,000, it would take 10 years if the whole global production was focused on replacing the transformers here in the United States, which is absolutely ridiculous.
That would take, We wouldn't be able to wait 10 years for all that stuff to be redone and put into place and restarted here and there and a few other places. This country would devolve into chaos, as well as much of Canada and northern Mexico, because they both are part of our grid. They get electricity from us.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and the world loses anywhere from 4 to 5 extra high voltage transformers daily. So there's always a production system going. But the amazing thing that Dr. Daniel Baker told me was that if we got hit by a coronal mass ejection from the sun, and I'll go into a little bit about how he explained it, it would affect the whole planet. It wouldn't just be the United States. It would be the whole Earth, and including those on the backside of the planet. But Daniel Baker said that he often likens the sun as obviously it's a churning, molting thermonuclear reaction that's happening billions and billions of times. A second, nuclear explosions is going off forever. But every once in a while, it'll pull out what's called a solar flare. And these flares, they can flash on the sun. And if you're looking at it in a telescope, it would arrive to the Earth in just a few seconds because it's traveling the speed of light. He said, but the flash of a flare on the sun is kind of like looking at the flash of a muzzle of a cannon. So you see the spark of the gunpowder going off. He said, but what you really have to be worried about is the cannonball, which is basically the coronal mass ejection. So what happens is every once in a while, one of these bands of a plasma breaks off like a rubber band, and this thing goes hurtling across space. It's called a magnetic flux rope. And this magnetic flux rope is usually anywhere from 500,000 to 1,000,000 miles long, and it morphs and weaves its way across the system, traveling at around 5 million miles an hour, a little bit more if it's a pretty significant one. So it'll hit us within about 17 hours or so, and we don't know what the polarity is of these things yet, and that kind of factors in with what I'm going to tell you. So there is a point in space called Lagrange Point 1, which is about 1,000,000 miles away from Earth. And that is the point in space where the sun's sun's gravity and the Earth's gravity are equal. So if you could imagine a beach ball on the 30-yard line of a football stadium, right? And you'd put a little pea on the goal line, and that would be the Earth, right? And then you put it'd be smaller than a pea. It'd be about the size of the doctor was saying, if you took Abraham Lincoln's eyeball on a $5 bill, that would be the size of the Earth on the goal line. And then at 3 inches away, you would put the size of Abraham Lincoln's head on the backside of a $5 bill. That would be the moon at 3 inches away. Well, on the one foot line, that's 1,000,000 miles away. You would have, that's where the Earth and the sun's gravitational forces are equal. So you're able to keep a satellite or a series of satellites in stationary orbit. And that's a key, because when that coronal mass ejection hits one of these satellites, it relays back to tell us what the polarity is. And the polarity is important, because if it's the same polarity as the Earth or the Earth's geomagnetic sphere, it will kind of glance off like two magnets that have equal polarity, you know, and you try to put them together and they kind of repel each other. Well, but if it's switched, then it couples with the coronal mass ejection, and it draws all that energy into the ground. And that's where we have a problem, because if that energy gets drawn into the ground, it eventually makes its way up from the ground to the transformer, which are now protected by grounding cables from lightning strikes to keep it safe. But in this scenario, if it's coming from the ground, we wouldn't be able to cut the cables quick enough to prevent them from being fried. And, you know, there's some debate as to how vulnerable they are. And that presents a real challenge to us, because the way the government, you know, is working, unfortunately for us, President, you know, we've asked for testing data and stuff, and it's just really been hard. Now, one of the scientists from the USGS, who's a good friend of mine, he lives here in Denver, named Dr. Jeffrey Love, is trying to finish the last part of the geomagnetic spectrum threat analysis for not only Colorado, because we only have 2/3 done, but and we have the other third completed, but also for the whole country. So we're still trying to understand exactly how capable this pulse would be coming up from the ground. Now, the theory has it that if you could power down the grid enough, that maybe it would be able to withstand some of the overcharge that this coronal mass ejection is putting on the system. But we're not sure. We're not sure if that's possible or not. Dr. Baker said, but that's not the end of it. We also have what's called an electrical magnetic pulse that comes from a device that could take out the grid as well. And I'm going, so there's more bad news. And the bad news is that you could theoretically create a electromagnetic pulse bomb, which is a very specialized nuclear device that's created not to do so much blasts, although you'd be incinerated if you were by it, but it's more designed to create a lot of gamma rays. And gamma rays are like millions of X-rays put in a short duration period of time. And the way Daniel Baker explained it is that these gamma rays that are produced in the upper atmosphere, they basically knock off electrons from various gases, not much oxygen up there at primary threat vector altitudes. But basically, the electrons get knocked off of these molecules, and they start an ionization or comptimization of the atmosphere, and they become ionized plasma. And so what happens is they create tiny little radio waves, and these tiny little radio waves get exacerbated, and they come down as trillions of little radio waves. And any cable on the planet, on the Earth, in their line of sight, would basically pick up these radio waves anywhere to a degree of 20 kilovolts per meter up to 80 to 100, and then it goes even higher than that. And so what Daniel Baker was saying is that this overcharge would destroy a lot of the things that we hold dear, not only transformers, but as you know, we have so many different SCADA devices. These are devices like little computers that monitor everything we do, from monitoring overpressure in gas lines and natural gas lines, and relay stations. They monitor how the grid, all these sensors are monitoring how the grid is operating, and those would all be taken out. Not only that, it would destroy all our GPS. So it basically produces something that causes a disruption from the coronal mass ejection, or from a geomagnetic, I should say, high altitude bomb, an EMP device that would basically fry our civilization.
Now, what you're talking about, I see as number one and two threats to our power grid, actually an EMP being first one.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is something much worse than what we're experiencing here with this pandemic of the coronavirus, because the coronavirus might kill people outright, but it eventually deteriorates the civil society because of people being afraid to get out and interact with each other and conduct commerce. Whereas these wipe out the grid, which prevents us from conducting commerce, and the only thing we have left is ourselves and fighting for whatever scraps of food and resources are available in your local area. So we're talking about something right now that's even worse than what we are experiencing with the virus situation around the globe.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But the EMP and the coronal mass ejection and or solar flare would be much worse than that.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And after I left that office, I told Dan that I was going to try to help get the message out. And he told me, though, as I was at the door, he said, Glenn, I do want to tell you one thing, that most people are going to come to your presentations when you will learn about it and when you present it. And they're going to ask, how can I build a better bomb shelter? He said, even though it's important for us to all be prepared at any one point in time, he said, the most important question is to turn that question around and say, yeah, you need to be prepared, but how do I save my community? In other words, that's a more important message from his perspective, because if we get hit by an EMP, for example, or a coronal mass ejection on the Front Range of Colorado, we'll lose 5 million Americans. We'll probably have on an estimate maybe 200,000 people survive. So that's why we need to turn around to say, are we going to focus in on 200,000 people living because they've built bomb shelters and they have all the food they need? Or are we going to figure out how to keep our critical infrastructure protected from all these threats?
Right.
So I went out and started doing some research. I called Dr. Peter Pry, and he called me. He talked to me right off the bat. And I said, Peter, you don't know me, but I'd like to help you out. And he goes, you're hired, basically, he said. And I go, Peter, I really had a clearance. He goes, I don't care. I go, why are you so quick to recruit me? And he goes, because nobody's getting it, Glenn. Nobody understands. I've been working the Congressional EMP Commission from 2001 to 2008, and then later 2016 to 2018. And we are studying the vulnerabilities of the power grid, and we're trying to make cost-effective recommendations that would protect the whole infrastructure in the United States, not only from EMP, but would mitigate to all hazards, including space, terrestrial weather, hurricanes, cyber threats. And as you know, just last year, remember when 23 commuter trains were wiped out in Japan, and it stranded thousands of different people in Tokyo, and they traced it back to one circuit breaker in one panel. And before they popped that thing open, they looked at the outside of it. They knew the short was inside. They looked on the outside. They couldn't see anything physically wrong with it. When they popped it open, there's a snail that went in there and created a short and knocked out 23 commuter trains.
All those lives because of a snail.
Yeah, and I've got a video in my presentations where I take a snail. It's a big huge snail, and it goes in through the cartridge of a ballpoint pen. It's the most amazing thing.
Wow.
And there was a little slit on that thing that they couldn't find, that, you know, initially, that it had gotten through there. So, you know, the fact that the coronavirus is kind of a shot over the bow, you know, I asked Peter, I said, Peter, how did you, you know, why did you start this whole thing? Well, what happened is Peter, in anticipation of the closure of the MP Commission officially in 2012, said, I'm going to start a 501c3 group, which you, Preston, are now a member of. And of course, we have a Western director, too, and a lot of other people that are volunteering their efforts to really keep that message going forward. You know, because even though we're not getting paid for this, it's a critically important message to say, hey, guys, if we don't fix these vulnerabilities of the power grid, what's going to happen is we're going to lose our country. And I asked Peter initially, I said, Peter, well, I think that Daniel Baker told me that we're not affected by the actual physical EMP spectrum radio wave. He said, why are so many people going to die? And he said, well, it's because as the EMP Commission did some research with the CDC, which kind of underlines the whole thing that we're going through with coronavirus, is the reason we have such a high estimate of anywhere from 250 to 288 million Americans perishing after an EMP event is because of the rise of the exposure of people dying from exposure because they won't have heat in their houses, mm-hmm. starvation, societal mm-hmm. collapse. I had an FBI agent say, Glenn, here in Denver, there are anywhere from 12 to 15,000 gangs that roam around and they're all held in check by law and order. But if we have a societal collapse because of an EMP or something else happens and we lose martial law control, these 15,000 gangs will now become looters and rioters and they will rape and pillage and cause destruction and societal chaos. Oh, and yeah. That's why the numbers are so hard. So now you add typhoid, diphtheria, and cholera onto COVID-19, because if you lose your ability to purify water, in other words, you can't shelter in place like we're sheltering now.
Right.
Preston, you're able to shelter in place because you're able to still poop and pee and drink fresh water from your bath, you know, from your bathrooms and your faucets in your kitchen, because we have that critical infrastructure, waste power treatment plants that are continuing to function. But imagine that you don't have any of the power now. What are you going to do? You're going to have to go to a stream, and that's where you're going to have this collapse of society. So that's why we're so adamant.
The downstream effects of all the stuff that goes in it and the disease that'll be created from it, and people being they'd be dying from chemical warfare, basically.
Oh yeah,
biological warfare. Yeah. Well, yeah. We're coming up on the hard end. So, can you give us just a real brief how people can get a hold of you, where they should go for more information, and what you would like to see happen with their new knowledge of the mission of the task force?
Yeah. Well, I think the number one thing is go to www.emptaskforce.us. You'll be able to contact any one of us through the email links there. Feel free to reach out to us because we need more volunteers in more states. We only have a few states still covered, but we need more and more people in their state and local communities. And then the other thing is, in light of this COVID thing, really take this whole sequestering seriously. Follow the directions of your public health administrators, because my daughter, who works in the front lines, she's an emergency room a physician's assistant. She said, Dad, it's going to get really bad. And if we don't soften the curve, meaning if we don't do our part to keep everybody sheltered in place so that we don't get a huge spike in all these people needing help, there's going to be a lot more people die. So we just need to take that really serious. Just stay shelter in place and then continue to reach out to you. Be a fan of your program, Preston. And I just want to thank you for being on.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure having you on the show. I know you're busy, and I appreciate you taking the time to be on. And There'll be more information on the show notes. There'll be the link to the website, and there's information there that you can download. There's some various pamphlets and a little booklet there, and other information that you can find. And we will help out wherever needed. And yes, we need more volunteers. So, with that said, civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based, grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on the top of our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def, that's D-E-F, _radio, where we post information on the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. We wish to thank Glenn for being on the show again, and we wish to thank you, our friends who listen to us regularly. I really appreciate you being on the show this week. So please be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.